Good morning. Today's daf in Ksuvos is Mem Dalid. We're beginning today on Mem Gimel Amud Beis. We're a little bit after the Mishnah. We're starting at the two dots immediately after the, not immediately after the Mishnah, but just a couple lines below. Mishnah yesterday turned its attention to a relatively new topic here in the fourth parak. First topic that we already covered in the fourth parak is just a capping off of the Onis HaMafata, and specifically who the recipient of the money is. It goes to the father. But we discussed that in slightly more detail. Here in this next mission that we started with yesterday, and that is, a man is Ma'aris Bito. He accepts Kesef Kedushin for the marriage of his daughter. And then what happens is that she only went through Erison, she got a divorce. And then what happens is that the father accepts Erison again for her. And then she becomes a widow. And yesterday we quickly pointed out that the Mishnah deliberately wanted to avoid this as a scenario in which she becomes widow twice, because if she becomes widow twice, so then she's a katlanis. Okay, but that's a side point. In other words, but the main point of the Mishnah is that under the circumstances where she is widowed, she becomes eligible two times over. So who gets ksuva money? So the Mishnah says, I'll tell you who gets ksuva money. The Mishnah says she's going to get the ksuva money. Right, Ma'aris is bita v'girsha eris of nisar melech ksuva shalom. Well, it depends. If she only went through erisin in both occasions, so by erisin the father still maintains jurisdiction over her, and all the money still go to the father. So that's if it's erisin. But if it is nisuin, so that means to say now that she goes through both stages of marriage, first and second stage of marriage. So under those circumstances, the money is going to be going to her. She will become the recipient. Why? Because with Nisuin, the act of Nisuin severs her from the father, and therefore she's going to become the recipient. Rav Yehuda argues on one point, and that is that in the case of Nisuin, father marries her off and she goes through both stages of marriage. Then she becomes eligible again. Father marries her off a second time. Now that's inaccurate. That's imprecise because the father's not marrying her off the second time. She is now herself. She's an independent. But regardless, she gets married a second time. So now, in such a scenario, the Tanakhama taught us that she's going to be receiving the ksuva two times over. Rav Yehuda says, I disagree on this point. And Rav Yehuda says that she will be receiving her second ksuva, but she will not be receiving her first ksuva. Who's going to be receiving her first ksuva? Her father. And the question of why. Why, according to Rav Yehuda, is the father going to be receiving the first ksuva? Seemingly, that does not make sense. Why? Because let's take the following into consideration. Now, I'm just setting us up for the Gemara. When she get married the first time, so again, Erisin, right? That's the first stage of marriage. And now, is the ksuva being written yet? Presumably, no. Now, again, in our Mishnah, obviously there was some sort of binding agreement at Erisin. Why? Because it's clear in the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah says in the first case where it's Erisin, so then the father's going to receive the ksuva. So there was clearly a agreement to a ksuva even at the point of Erisin. But typically, the ksuva is actually written up at the point of Nisuin. So, in the case of Nisuin, so she really should be the rightful recipient of the ksuva, not only the second time, but even the first time. Because again, with Nisuin, two things are happening concurrently. One, is she severed from her father. Two, is that the ksuva obligation now kicks in. So, she should be the recipient of the of that first ksuva. All I'm effectively saying is, the Chachamim seem to be right. And meanwhile, Rav Yehuda says, in such a case, the father's going to be receiving the first ksuva, and she's going to be receiving the second ksuva. So it begs the question, which the Gemara now is about to ask. So Rav Yehuda, Amar Rishon HaShalab, my time into Rav Yehuda. So what is the reason behind Shitas Rav Yehuda? So Rabbi Rav Yosef Dami Tavayho, Mishas Yerusin Zachabahen Ha'av. So the Gemara first offers the following. Well, maybe it was that the father acquired it. He was Zoche at the time of Erisin. So the Gemara says, no, Masav Rava, Rabbi Yehuda Omer. So Rava says, no, that can't be the pshat. Why? Because of the following Braisa. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rishon HaShalava, Umode Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, so here in this Braisa, we start off with what we learned in our Mishnah, that according to Rabbi Yehuda, the father will be the recipient of the first ksuva. However, Umode Rabbi Yehuda, Bamaris is Bito Kishikatana. However, In the event where Erisin occurred while she was a Katana, meaning the father accepted Erisin on her behalf, Ubagra, and now what happens is she becomes a Bogeris. And V'archakach Niseis, Ein Lavi Erishos Ba. And then what happens is that she becomes a Bogaris and she goes through the second stage of marriage, Nisuin. So now, Ein Avi Rishus Bab. The father is not going to have any entitlement whatsoever. He's not going to be receiving the Ksuva. So, if we were correct, am I? Let's just argue what we argued just moments earlier. Meaning, if the father was Zoch at Erison, because the Ksuva was written up at Erison, so then in this case as well, the father should be the recipient of the Ksuva. And meanwhile, in the Braisa, we are saying it clearly, the father is not the recipient of the Ksuva. Ali Idmar Hachi Idmar. So the Gemara says, okay, so back to the drawing board. Okay, let's reset. Rabbi Yehuda says that in the event that he marries off his daughter while she is a Nara, and she goes through both stages of marriage, Erison Nisuin, then again, she becomes eligible, gets married again, Erison Nisuin. So according to the Tanakhama, she gets her Ksuva not once but twice. She gets that first and second Ksuva. According to Rabbi Yehuda, she only gets the second Ksuva, but the first Ksuva goes to the father. And we are racking our brains. Why is the father getting the first Ksuva? So Ella Itmar Hachi Itmar. So the Gemara says, okay, here's Pshat. Rabbi Rav Yosef Darmi Tavai Ho Verushuso Nichtavim. Because the Ksuva was written up during Erisin. The writing of the Ksuva. So in other words, what we have over here is the Ksuva that was written during Erisin. And again, it's not traditional. It's not traditionally done. Generally speaking, the Ksuva was written at Nisuin. But over here, in this particular circumstance, once the Ksuva is written during Erisin, so therefore, it has a collecting ability during Erisin. Now, who has jurisdiction during Erisin? The father. Therefore, the father becomes the recipient. So, Umigba Emas Gavya. All right, so, with that stated, so now here's what we just learned together. That as far as any kind of commitments are concerned, when a woman typically gets married, the Ksuva is normally written, traditionally written up, at the point of Nisuin, that is generally speaking when the Ksuva is, all the Ksuva obligations take effect. However, if you want to draft a document during Erisin, again, it's not traditionally done, but if you want to do that, so then it creates a binding contract at that point in time. And since the father had jurisdiction at that point in time, at least according to the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, so then the father is in fact going to be able to collect it. Now, So, when are we collecting? Now, when the Gemara's question, when are we collecting? So let's be right. That's better stated. From when are we collecting? Meaning, let's go over some basics regarding notes of obligation. Notes of obligation now are obviously collectible. Now, what happens when you're holding a note against somebody and he defaults? Okay, so I'll tell you what happens. It happens everywhere, all the time, every country. Well, I could really speak for America the most, but what happens is now is that in the event of default, so what you're going to do is that you're going to go after his assets, specifically real estate. You're going to go after properties. So what happens is that you're going to be holding a lien against his properties, and that lien against that property now is going to be the security of where you're going to be able to collect your money. That means to say that going back to the origination of the loan, any properties that he had, you are holding a lien on those properties. Those properties are sold. You're a lien holder. Okay, good. So now you're a lien holder from what point in time? From the origination of the loan. Meaning that if he sold properties before the loan took place, so obviously you don't have a lien on those properties. You only have a lien on those properties, on any properties that he owned from the origination of the loan. Now here's what we're asking. We're asking now that Ksuva was written during Erisin. A Ksuva was then rewritten, hold on one second. We'll get to that in just a moment. A Ksuva was written during Erisin. Now, question on the table. From what point in time now can we collect this Ksuva? So, Umigba Imeim is Gavya. Amar Ravuna Manu Masayim Min Erisin V'Tosefes Min Anisuin. So, Ravuna will say like this. What we're going to do is that we're going to break up the Ksuva into two parts. Its base amount and whatever additional amount that you want to write. Its base amount, whether it's going to be Manu Masayim, depending on whether she's a Basula or Ba'ula. So the base amount goes back to the time of Erisin, meaning if in the event that was written at the time of Erisin. And as far as Tosefis is concerned, Tosefis is going to be collected only from the point of Nisuin. Okay? And Ravasi Amar Echetzeve Echetzem in a Nisuin. And Ravasi will tell you that no, that they are both going to be collected from Nisuin. Meaning, even though the ksuva was written up during erusin, but if you draft a new ksuva at the point of nisuin, the new ksuva being written up at nisuin is going to just simply take over the obligation altogether. And therefore, you only will be able to collect from the point of nisuin, not any earlier. Umi amar Rav Huna hachivaha veha itmar utzi alav shtei ksuvas achash amasam vachash shalosh meos veamar Rav Huna basal gavas masam govim mizman rishon shalosh meos govim mizman sheni. Ah. We are first bothered by the sheet of Rav Huna. Rav Huna breaks it up between the base amount and the additional amount. Rav Huna says is that what we'll do is we'll take the ksuva. Base amount goes back to the time that was originally written up, and any additional amount goes back to the time of Nisun, which is a later date. That's what we heard just moments earlier. Meanwhile, we are now learning that, let's say, for whatever reason, she's holding up two ksuvas. She has a ksuva of 200 with an earlier date. She has a ksuva of 300 with a later date. So now Rav Huna says, okay, I'll tell you what you do, and that is choose. In other words, if you want to use the 200 ksuva, use it. If you want to use the 300, use that. The advantage of the 200 is that its lien goes back earlier historically. So that means to say that you will have more ability to collect from more properties, assuming, of course, that in this case, the borrower, he's not really a borrower, he's a husband, but regardless, the one who owes, so presumably he'll have properties going back historically. So between Eris and Nisuin. So if you have an earlier start, even though the amount that you can collect is less, it's only 200, but still, it will give you more of a reach in terms of your lien, as opposed to the 300, where even though it allows you to collect more, but you'll have less of a reach in terms of the lien. Now, v'imisa tikba masayim bizman rishon or mea bizman sheni. So the Gemara says, now, let's assume that what Rav Huna, moments earlier, you know what you said? You said that we could break up a ksuva between base amount and tosefes. So if that's true, why don't we say the same thing over here? So why don't we say that on the second ksuva of 300, why don't we break it up to between base amount of 200 and the tosefes of 300? So the Gemara says, "Latamech tig bechamesh meos kulam masayim mizman rishon, klas meam mizman sheni." So the Gemara says, come on. How about this? In other words, as long as you're asking questions, allow me to ask a question. And that is that if she's holding two ksuvas, one for 200, one for 300, why don't we look at it like this? Why don't we say that the first ksuva is the base amount? The second ksuva is in the entirety of it being a tosefes. Why don't we do that? So, elachamish meos maitam alogavya, kevin delo kasavla, tzivisivos, if delachatlas mea masayim. So the Gemara says, because I'll tell you why. Read the documents, read the ksuvas. If the second ksuva would have said, this is an addendum to the first ksuva, okay, great, mazel tov. So then obviously then the 300 is on top of the 200, and shalma yisrael. But that's not what it says. In other words, the second ksuva looks like a totally new vehicle. It looks like a new entity. So hachi kamarla, ibn zman rishon gavias gavya masayim, ibn zman sheni gaviasa gavya klasmeya. The way to interpret the two ksuvas is the following. When he drafted the second document, he basically was saying to her the following. Look, here's your choice. You can either come at me with the 200, which again, predates earlier, gives you more of a reach in terms of your lien. Alternatively, you can come at me with the 300, but you have less of a reach in terms of your lien. So I give you the choice. Meaning, so you now have options. But that's how to interpret the two documents. We're not going to interpret the second document as just simply an addendum to the first document. We'll only do that if it says so. If it actually writes on the second document, this is an addendum to the first document. But if it doesn't do that, so then the proper way to interpret is the way we just presented. So hachinami, hainetam, midlo gavi, midlo kasav, la usif tolcha mea masayim. So the achule, achil tol shibude kama. So the Gemara says, if that's true, So why don't we say the same thing over here? Meaning, that in the event that that I have a document of, let's say, in Rav Huna scenario, where I have now a document that is 300, so why don't we just simply say, that we are going to be looking at the second document not as a division between base amount and additional amount, but rather why don't we look at it as a separately drafted document? So Okay. The Amar Mar, Ibais Bahai Gavya, Ibais Bahai Gavya. So fine. Okay, fine. The let's pause over here. So so what do we have right now? So what we have is the following. We are discussing the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah. In our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda says that if the ksuva was written during Erusin, so what it allows her to do is, what it allows the father to do is to collect the ksuva from that first marriage. She went through both stages of marriages, Erusin and Nisuin, and at Nisuin she severed from the father, which means that she should be the eligible recipient of the ksuva. So in explanation of Rabbi Yehuda, so we were given two possible ways to understand it. One is that of, one of that of Rav Asi, and the other one of Rabbi and Rav Yosef, one of Rabbi and Rav Yosef, and that is Hol Virshus Nechtavin, that it was written while it was during Erusin. On that, the Gemara goes on to discuss. So that if, let's say, a document was drafted that exceeds the base amount, so now, in terms of her ability to collect, how is that going to be looked at? Again, it was an Erusin ksuva that was written earlier. How is she going to be able to collect that? So according to Rav Huna, we'll break it up between the base amount and the extra amount. And according to Rav Asi, no, we don't break it up between base amount and Tosefus, but rather, according to Rav Asi, it's all going to be obligated from the point of Nisuin. And meanwhile, according to Rav Huna, the base amount will go back to the point of Erusin, and any additional amount will go back to the point of Nisuin. Okay. We then moved on to discuss what happens when she presents two ksuva documents. According to Rav Huna, so she can collect from either one. And again, the choice is either 200 going back to the earlier date or 300 going back to the later date. Again, pluses and minuses in both directions. Amar Mar. Ibai Mahai Gavya, Ibai Mahai Gavya. Lema Pligi de Rav Nachman. I think the Gemara says that this proposal of Rav Huna, that when a woman has two ksuvas, an earlier and a later one, earlier for a less amount, later one for more of an amount, and she has the option, she can use whichever one she wants. In other words, whichever will work more advantageous to her. It is effectively just a simple business decision. So the Gemara says, I think this ruling of Rav Huna is going to go against Rav Nachman. How do I know that? Lema pligi de Rav Nachman, damar Rav Nachman, shtei shor, say yosim b'zeh hazeh. So bitel sheni sarishon. So let's say I have two documents of sale. Okay, and a property was sold, and the buyer, oddly enough, is not holding one but two different documents. So, what happens is that the second document is going to override the first document. It just simply nullifies the first document. So, on this, what comes out now is the following. If I have two notes, one followed after another, so we just learned that according to Rav Nachman, in the case of sale, the second one just simply overrides the first one, and according to Rav Huna, no, both documents are in effect. And again, there's a reason why she'd want to use one over the other. Each one of them has its own advantage. One document, even though for a less base amount, has an earlier historical date, so it gives her more reach in terms of her lien. The second document is going to be for more, but in other words, historically goes back to a later point in time, which gives her less of a reach in terms of her lien. It sounds like Rav Huna is in argument with Rav Nachman. The Gemara says, no, it's not true. La mi itmar la mi rapapa moda Rav Nachman di yemosef beidikla tosefes kasvei hachanami ha-osef le-midi. So the Gemara immediately says, wait one second. If the second document, Rav Nachman will tell you that if the second document adds any additional amount, right, even a tree, a single tree, so then the second document there is not to override the first document. The second document is understood as an additional. It's a osafa. Okay. So Rav Nachman is not going against Rav Huna. We now have two psakim, one by Rav Nachman, the other by Rav Huna, and they seem to be basically on point. And that is that if the second document is adding a dimension to the first document. It is not overwriting the first document. The first document is still enforced. It just happens to be that the second document is adding. So over here, in the case of Rav Huna, the second ksuva is a higher amount. So in other words, so does it override the first document? No, it doesn't, because the first document has an advantage in that it goes back further back historically, gives her more ability to exercise the lien on earlier properties that were owned. In the case of Rav Nachman, there were two documents of sale. The second document has an osafa. It actually has an additional parcel of land that was added to it. Okay, so that means that the first document is there for the original sale, and the second document was for the extra. Good. Gufa Amar Rav Nachman Sheshar Siyotzim Bezeh Chazeh, Bito Shenes Arishon, V'Amar Apapa Moder Rav Nachman Yosef Beidikla, L'Tosefes Kasvei. So good, so we just reset Rav Nachman together with Rav Papa's point. The Gemara says Pshita. I'll tell you what I think is obvious. Let's start off with the following. So Rishon B'Mecher Shene B'Matana. So Liyafas Kochu DeKasav Le Mishum Dina DeBar Mitzvah. Okay, let's say the following. Okay, same piece of land I purchased, and so the first document that drafted the first sale document was written up as a sale. Second document now that was written up was that this land was gifted to me. So to which now the Gemara says, here's what I think is obvious. I think that that both documents are in force. I think that the second document adds a dimension. What's the dimension that is added by the second document? And that's the following, Dina de Bar Mitzvah. Okay, so what is Dina de Bar Mitzvah? We're going to see all this in Baba Basra in detail, but it's very straightforward. And that is the following, is that when you're selling a property, so the neighbor has the first option to go ahead and to purchase that land. Meaning, assuming that the sale price is the same, right? If you can get a larger sale price from anybody else, okay, then we have what to talk about. But assuming that the sale price is the same, so the requirement is that you must sell it to the neighbor. The neighbor obviously has a certain advantage of expanding his territory, and so therefore you must sell it to the neighbor. And it's not just a nice thing to do, it's not just ideal, it's a requirement. You must sell it to the neighbor. This only applies in the case of a sale. In the case of a gift, so then there's no reason why you need to go to the neighbor and say, hey, I'm gifting it, would you like it? In other words, in the case of a gift, I clearly designated that I like this person, and therefore I want to give it to this person. When everything is equal, and you're going to be getting your money anyway, so then you have to go to the neighbor and offer it to the neighbor as a sale. But once you do it as a gift, you can gift it to anyone you want, and you don't have to go to the neighbor. So when you make a sale of a land, first with a sale document and then with a gift document, so what the gift document does is that it protects the buyer. Now here, I don't fully understand. I'm just admitting right now. In other words, if in fact it was a sale, so why the gift document per se should go ahead and protect the buyer if in fact he actually purchased it? I don't fully understand, but the Gemara's assumption right now is that a gift document is going to go in and protect him from the neighbor. Fine. So assuming that that's true, which the Gemara assumes is correct, so then I understand that there is a benefit. There's an additional gain by that second document. Alternatively, if let's say the first document was a gift document and the second document was a sale document, that I certainly understand that the second document now is going to go ahead and benefit the buyer. Why? Because on a gift document, let's say that the gifter defaulted on a loan, and along comes the creditors. Then what does he do? He takes the land right away from you. He rightfully can do so. In other words, he had a lien on this property. So in the case of a gift, are you going to get reimbursed? Of course, the answer is no. You're not getting reimbursed because you never laid out money for it. But in the case of a sale where you purchased a property, so generally speaking, there's something called achrayus, which means now that in the event that the land is taken away from you from a creditor, from a lien holder, so now you go back to the seller and you say to the seller, okay, I don't have the land anymore, you'll give me back my money. And assuming that the land was sold with achrayus, you're entitled to do so. If it's a sale document, so that sale document is basically now your receipt allowing you to go ahead and get reimbursed on the sale. Oh, so the Gemara says that if it's a gift document filed, then by a sale document, that obviously serves as a benefit. Ella, ishneim mecher, ishneim b'matana, bital shenis arishon. So, Rav Nachman's halacha, that the second one is going to be totally overriding the first one, is when everything is equal. The first and second are both sale documents. The first and second one are both gift documents. Under those circumstances, if the second one is only but repetitive of the first, so then the second one becomes a bittul, a nullification of the first. Okay, so my time up.
But the Baal Chayim can go and take the gift field. He has to go to the sales field.
Yeah, now he has a lien. He has a lien on the property. So he could take whatever property he had a lien on and take it, whether it was gifted away or whether it was sold, it doesn't matter. He had a lien on the property. Okay. Now my timer. Okay, good. So now we're just the first thing we did is we just fine tuned Rav Nachman's halacha that if there are two documents and they are repetitive, so the second one is going to override the first one. Okay, now. Good? Yes, it's good, but why? Meaning, why should the second one be mevatel to the first one? And keep in mind that what now happens is that it shifts over the date. Meaning now, because we are mevatel to the first one, so the dating now goes to the second, not to the first. Okay. So, why is it that the second one is going to negate the first one? So my time. That's Gemara's next question. The Gemara gives two explanations. So Rafa Mamra Emar Uduya Udele Ravachamra Emar Chula Achlule Lishibude. To which the Gemara gives two explanations. One is basically an admission, and the other one is Mechila. Now, an admission. Admission to what? So that's Rafam. Rafam says it's an admission. It's an admission to the first one being no good. Meaning, why are we redrafting another document that is repetitive of the first one? So Rafam says, oh, I know why. Because basically you're saying that the first one was forged. It was just simply a bad document. It was no good. The witnesses signed on it, and meanwhile the witnesses signed on nothing. Meaning it did not represent an actual sale. Someone forged the document. That's one possibility. The other possibility, Rav Acha says, no. It's because you were simply mochel. Meaning that as somebody who purchased the property earlier, and again, basically what happens now is that, look, I know I purchased the property earlier, but you know what? Let's waive all that. And now we'll do a repurchase of the property. Not really a repurchase, but anything going back historically in time, you know what? I'm mochel. And we're going to go to the second date. Okay. Why would anyone do that? Hold that thought. So my beinah, you can beinah. So the Gemara says, okay, so how to interpret a second document that is repetitive of the first document? Either it speaks poorly of the first document, or it's just a function of mechila. Now, again, if I may, again, I'm not fully understanding. Why don't we investigate the matter? Meaning, if both options, you know, there are two possibilities. Either one of them may be correct. Not every case is going to be the same. So, do I fully understand this? No, I don't fully understand this, but maybe we're talking about generically. Whatever the case may be, the Gemara now is proposing that it's one of these two. Might be now, the Gemara says now the difference between them is going to be either number one, Urui Sahade. So, the witness is signing on the first document. If you understood like Raphram, that we're admitting that the first document is a forged document. Well, if the first document is a forged document, what does it speak to about the witnesses who signed on the document? They were ready to sign on a forged document. Okay. So nafkamina number one, from Rafram's standpoint, any witnesses associated with the first document, they're no good. According to Rav Acha, no, they're fine. It was just a mechila. Number two, Lishlame Peire. Oh. Here we go. Now, number two. Let's say now there's a month discrepancy between the first and second document. And now the buyer has been enjoying the fruit for that month. If we understand that what we're doing is that we're discrediting the first document, so that means that the sale did not take place. You have now, for the last month, illicitly have taken fruit off of property that does not belong to you. Oh. So now what does that mean? It means that you're going to have to reimburse any fruit that you've taken over the course of the month. On the other hand, if we're talking about mechila, you know what mechila means? Mechila means that we waived it. Okay, that's nafkamina number two. Nafkamina number three, taska. Taska, by the way, and I'm sure the words are related, tax. In other words, property taxes. Who's paying the property taxes for the last month? So if we're saying that the first document was a forged document, so that means that the seller was still in holding of the property. He's responsible for the property tax. If, on the other hand, we're talking about mechila, so mechila now means that that the sale actually did go through. It's just that he was mochel. Okay, so three nafkaminas between Rafram and Rav Acha in terms of why it is that Rav Nachman says that when a document is redrafted and seemingly every detail is the same and there's no benefit to the second document over the first document, so it negates the first document. Why should it be? The Gemara gave two explanations with nafkaminas between these two explanations. All this brings us back to the Ksuva. I'm sure you noticed, by the way, that we went off on a little bit of a trek over here, meaning that we have now spent most of today's daf going over what happens when I have a repetitive document. And this is, takes us back to now the whole conversation started because we talked about a woman who has two ksuvas in her possession, one for 200, one for 300. The 200 goes back to an earlier date, 300 to a later date, benefits to either one of them. She can exercise whichever one she wants. Good. Now the Gemara says, "Lemai havela diksuva." So now let's go back to the ksuva. So Tashma, Dam Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Mishum Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon, Mana Masai Min Eirusin, and Tosefus Min Hanesuin, V'Chacham Amorim, Echazeh V'Echazeh Min Hanesuin, V'Hilchasa Echazeh V'Echazeh Min Hanesuin. Let's say we go all the way back to the ksuva that was drafted up at Eirusin, and then what happens is that Tosefus was what was added at the Nesuin. So now, in terms of the Gevia, in terms of your ability to collect, are we going to break it up between base amount and additional amount? Machlokis. And the Gemara concludes that we are not going to break it up. Meaning that at the point of Nesuin, even though there was a Ksuva written up at Erisin, but if a Ksuva was redrafted at Erisin with a Tosefes, all of it's going to take effect, kick in at the point of Nesuin. Okay.
So that means that the second one is like Mevatel the first one.
Right, correct. We take ourselves now up to the next Mishnah and a totally new topic here in the fourth parak of the Masechta. We're going to be talking about Motzi Shemra. Okay, a couple of brief moments of introduction. Okay, Motzi Shemra is a woman who's accused of being Mizana, but under very specific circumstances where the husband's the one making the accusation. Marries this woman. And I don't know if there's a statute of limitation, but his claim is as follows. He goes into court sometime soon after he married her, he's with her. And sometime soon thereafter, he goes over to the basin and he says, my wife, while she was in Arusa, she was with another man. And obviously his claim alone is not going to create any kind of criminal case against her, but he brings an Edom. And the Edom that he brings in is now going to tell us that they saw her be with another man during Erisin. Okay, now, under normal circumstances, when a woman is accused by two witnesses of being with another man, so that's called niyuf, that's called adultery. And assuming that the witnesses issued a warning and many other points of due process, but assuming that we went through all that, so now she is subject to the capital punishment of chenek. She's going to be put to death specifically with the form of chenek. In the case of Motzi Shemra, so the Torah goes over two scenarios. In other words, both starting with the husband being the one bringing in the Edom and specifically accusing her of committing adultery during Erisin and specifically while she was in Ara. Meaning the Parsha is very clear that this is a very specific set of circumstances. Now, ultimately, it's a case of Niyuf, but because it's the husband, because it was during Erisin, and because it was while she was in Ara, so everything gets amped up. Number one, in terms of what her punishment's going to be, it's going to be skila. Okay. Now, why should that be? So that's a wonderful question, and the whys are the ones where I struggle the most. In other words, those are the hard questions to answer. It could be, I'll tell you what. Let me not suggest. I don't have any good sourcing. What I'm going to say is more intuitive. I'll just... I'll decline. Okay, I'll leave it off as a good question. Why does she get a higher degree of punishment?
The event actually occurred, you're saying?
Oh, okay, fine. So now, if the event actually occurred and the witnesses are proved to be good witnesses, so she's going to get skila. But let's say the witnesses that the husband brought in were no good. Okay? In other words, they just simply are bad witnesses. So under those circumstances, now this falls under the category of being motzi shemra. Motzi shemra now means that the husband has maligned his new wife. Under such circumstances, so the husband now is going to be treated to a lot of consequences. Let's go over them. Number one, he's going to get malchus. Number two, he's going to have to pay a knas of 100 shkalim, which is the highest knas that the Torah imposes. We talked about onus and mafata being 50 shkalim. The death of an eved kanani by Yeshua Muad is 30 shkalim. I'm just giving us all reference points, right? The motzi shemra, 100 shkalim. And finally, last and not least, is that they're married already, but he's not allowed to divorce her. So three consequences for the motzi shemra in the event that the witnesses turned out to be no good.
Aren't the
Eidim Zomimim? So, right, how are the Eidim discredited? So probably the best example would be Eidim Zomimim. Okay. Now, that would be the best way to illustrate how the witnesses were discredited. Okay, so with all that stated, so we start now our Mishnah. Hagiroshin is Gairabita Imam. So let's say we have a conversion of mother and daughter. Now the daughter is really young. Tosus explains that so young that she needed a sponsor. Right? I know early in the Masechta we talked about Beis Din being a sponsor, but right now the mother's a sponsor. She's under 3 years of age. So Hagiroshin is Gairabita Imam Vizinsa Hareza Bechenek. So under those circumstances, she's not going to be subject to the skila penalty. The skila penalty is only somebody who was born Jewish. Okay, why should that be? It's a drasha. We'll get to it later on. So over here, later on historically, where she commits adultery, so again, as a technicality, she's only going to be getting the baseline execution of chenek. Okay. Ein la lo pesach beitzah v'lo me'asela. Additional to that, she's not going to be taken to the entrance of her father's house, a detail that I didn't go over in my introduction, but it's certainly not too late. In the case of Motzi Shemra, where he was right, where the Eidim actually proved to be good Eidim, so she's going to get Skila. On top of that, she's also going to get Skila in front of her father's house. Okay. That's not normally where Skila is done. In other words, there normally is a place set up for Skila. But in the case of Nara Murasa, where she committed adultery during Erusin, she was still under the jurisdiction of her father. And so this part I'm comfortable saying because I think it's pretty obvious. Meaning because she's still with her father, she's still living in her father's house, so it speaks ill of the father. And so therefore the skila is done over there. Okay. So in the case where she converted, so this detail is not going to happen. There's no Pesach Beis Av. There's not going to be Me'asela. Fine. Ha'isa rasa shalom b'kdusha v'lei dasa b'kdusha reze b'skila. V'ein la lo Pesach Beis Av v'lo Me'asela. Now, if let's say, for example, the mom became pregnant before she converted, but then converted during pregnancy, and now what comes out of her is a Jew. In other words, right, as far as the conversion of the fetus is concerned, elsewhere, the Gemara talks about how when mom goes into the mikvah, that mikvah works for her and for the fetus as well. But basically, she's born a Jew, so she now is subject. She's eligible to skila. Okay, I'm saying this with sarcasm. The benefit of being a Jew. She's eligible for skila, but in la pesach beisav she does not have. She's not, the skila is not going to be done in front of her father's house. Her father is not halachically her father. And, velo me'asela. And, also the me'asela in the event that the husband was being motzi shemra. Haisa arosa v'lei dasa b'kdusha harei hikabas yisho l'chol d'vareha. Yesh la'a v'ein, I'm sorry, l'chol d'vareha. And then, if let's say, the father, converted, before impregnating the mother. So in other words, mom and dad were converts and then conception. So now she is a full-fledged Jew. And again, in the case of Motzi Shemra, if the witnesses are in fact telling the truth, so now everything's in effect. She's going to receive skila. She's going to receive skila in front of Beis Avia, etc., etc. Now, yesh la av ein la pesach Beis Av. Yesh la pesach Beis Av ein la av. Harezu beskila lo nemar pesach Beis Av ela la mitzvah. Let's say there is a father, but there's no house. Let's say there's a house, but there's no father. In other words, no father, meaning father, the dad died. So in either of these circumstances, so this is just a detail. Ein li ela la mitzvah. And so therefore, she's still going to get skila. And in the event that the husband maligned her, he's going to be subject to all the punishments and all the penalties. It's just the father and the Beis Avia are just la mitzvah, meaning if there's a father and if there's a house, so then the skila will be done in front of her house. But in absence of either one of those two, you're going to still do the execution. You'll still do the execution of skila. Okay.
But not in front of the house.
Right. Correct. Not in front of the house. Menan imili. Amri shlakish amakra. Okay. Right. Good. We are now on Mem Dalam and Beis. We're starting with the Gemara. So the Gemara wants to know the first halacha that we learned together. Right, that if a woman was born where conception occurred before dad converted and mom converted, and then during pregnancy mom converted, and now she comes out. So the we learned in the Mishnah that she's still going to get skila. So from where does this come from? Amar Shlakish Amakra Umeisa LeRabos Harasa Shlo Bekdusha V'Lei Dasa Bekdusha. So the Gemara says is that where we learn this from is the is a drasha, right? The Umeisa, right? It's an additional. The word Mesa is Miuseres, and so therefore it's coming to include. So Ihachi Milka Nami Nilke Umea Sela Nami L'Shalem. So the Gemara says, well, that's. In other words, in Motzi Shemra, there's two sides to this coin. Meaning, on one side of the coin, it's what if he's right? On the other side of the coin is, and what if he's wrong? So, we are now saying that we have a drasha that tells us that, in the event that he's right, and again, he being right, meaning that the witnesses are proved to be good witnesses. So, in the event that he's right, so she's going to receive skila. So, wait a second. So, now let's flip the coin over. Now, what if he's wrong? So, now, if she was eligible for skila, if he was right, so shouldn't it mean that if he was wrong, so now he should be subject to all the punishments of a Motzi Shemra, the Malkus, the 100 Shkalim? So the Gemara says, Amakra Umesa. Misa Nisrabah V'lo L'Knas. So the Gemara says, okay, it happens to be that this particular Riboy is only one-sided Riboy. Okay? Unfair? No, not unfair. It's just that's Xeris HaKasif. That's just simply how this particular Riboy works. So I understand. Why don't we say that the Rebu is talking about where the conception and the birth occur after mom converted? So the Gemara says, I don't need a Rebu for that. You know what that's called? It's called a Jew. So the Emel Rabos Harasa Veleidasa Shlo Bekdusha. So Im Kain B'Yisrael Menahanilei. Yeah, the Gemara says, okay, so how about this? How about the Rebu goes even further? How about the Rebu is even when mom comes in to convert after she gave birth, maybe the ribui is for that as well. So the Gemara says no, because it says asa nevala bi Yisrael, meaning we need an element, we need a degree of she was born Jewish. Okay, so therefore the sweet spot is that the conception occurred before the conversion of the mother, but then before the baby was born, before she was born, the mom converted. That's where we are in terms of the drasha. I'm Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanin Amotzi Shemra Ali Yisoma Pater. If let's say the husband was Motzi Shemra and at the time dad was dead and the witnesses proved to be lying, so now he does not have to pay the Me'ah Shekel. Shenamar v'nasnu la'avia nara pralezu she'ein la'av. Okay, and the reason why we know this is because of a drasha. So the Gemara says, "Mesiv Rav Yosi Bar Avin Vitem Rav Yosi Bar Zvi Davi Imayin Yamein Avi Ala Rabbis Yisom LaKnas Div Rav Yosi Aglili." So the Gemara says, "Wait one second. When it comes to pitui, and by extension, when it comes to ones, so we know that the knas is going to be imposed even if there's no father. So who most of love mefarik la v'va'ala v'achar kach nisyasma. So the Gemara says, no, that drasha of Rav Yossi Haglili is only where there was a father at the time of the Onis, and then the father died subsequently. Rav Amar Chayev. Rava disagrees. Rava says that if a man is mostly shamer on his wife, and she happened to have been a Yosoma, and he was lying, so there is going to be imposing the kenas. And I know that because of the following brisa that was given over by Ami. So besulas Yisrael v'lo besulas gerim. It has to be she's a besulas Yisrael, not besulas gerim. A pasuk comes to exclude a ger. Now, if we're saying that in the absence of a father, so we waive the kenas penalty, so then a ger by definition is going to get waived. Why? Because a ger by definition, or in this case a gioris by definition, doesn't have a father halachically. But meanwhile, I have a drasha that comes to exclude it. So ella yamar b'Yisrael ki I gavna pater hashu b'Yisrael pater begerim mi baye. Okay, so if in the case of Yisrael without a father, you're going to be pater. By Giyaris, I knew that already. So in other words, the drasha is coming to tell me that in the event that there was a father and the father died, so under those circumstances, the kenas is still in force. In the case of the Giyaris, we have a special drasha that tells us that there's a patur of the kenas. Okay. Where do we stand right now? We introduced ourselves to Motzi Shemra. We learned together that there are a couple of details by Motzi Shemra which will affect whether or not in the event that he was lying and he maligned her, whether or not all the penalties are going to be in play. A debate in terms of when she is a Yosoma, are the penalties going to be in play? Machlokas amongst the Amoraim. One more point for today. Amar Yish Lakish Motzi Shemra al Haktana Pater. Okay, if let's say he's mostly shemra, and at the time she was a katana, so now pater. Now, when we say pater over here, once again, we're not talking about where he was right, because if in the event that he was right, that's not called niyuf, it's not called adultery. She is a katana, she's a minor. She's not going to be put to death over any of her actions. She does not have das. She did not choose to do the avera. Halacha views a katan or a katana as somebody without das. What we mean to say is as follows, is that he maligned her, meaning he married her as a katana. He accused her of having relations with another man. Again, in the event that he's right, she's not going to be put to death. But in the event that he maligned her, so he's not going to be subject to the penalties of malchus, kenas, and I guess he also can divorce her. So how do I know that? Because when the Torah introduces us to Motzi Shemra, it writes the word Na'ara with a hey at the end. Okay, for those of you who lane, so you know this. And that is that most of the time, the vast majority of the time in the Torah, where the Torah says the word Na'ara, it's without a hey. We made this point already earlier in the Masechta. This is the second time now we're making this point. So it's without a hey. Here, by Motzi Shemra, it's with a hey. And that tells me that it's specifically Nara, not Katana. Yeah. To which the Gemara says, so Maskel Ravacha Bar Ada Taimed Ksiv by Hanara, Lavach Yava Mina Filu Katana, Veha Ksivi, Memes Ayadavar Azel, O Nimsu Besul Nara, Vosias Anara, Pesach Besavia, Skalua, Katana Lav Boson Chinhin. Now it has to be a Nara, it can't be a Katana, because again, we went over this point. In the event that he was right, that the Aiden were correct, so then what are you going to do? You're going to put her to death? Of course you're not going to put her to death. In other words, she's a Katana. So we know by definition that Nara here in the case of Motzi Shemra is by definition a Nara. So Ella, the Gemara says you're right. Ka Nara, hakol makom shenemar Nara afilu katana b'mashma. The Gemara says correct, opposite. Meaning, by virtue of the fact that here it's Nara, and we know that Nara over here means the Nara to the exclusion of a katana, that means every other place you're going to see Nara, you're going to see it chaser, you'll see it without the hay. So then that means that it's Nara included in that katana as well. Right? Go back to the beginning of the third parak. We did this together. In the beginning of the third parak. So who's subject to the kenas of Ones and Mefata? So again, there is a sheet of Reb Meir. Reb Meir says that it's Nara and not Ketana, but the Chachamim are of the position that's Nara and Ketana. Now, how do we know that? Good. So I know, tucked away here in the fourth Perek, but the truth of the matter is the second time we did this already. We did this already back in the third Perek. This is our Makor. We know that because by Motzi Shemra, it says Nara with a Hay. By definition, it has to be a Nara to the exclusion of Ketana. That means now that we can work backwards. Nara without a Hay, that is, if you will, I know I said the same thing last time. It's Nara minor, meaning it's Nara, but not to the exclusion of Ketana. It's Nara and Ketana. So now I know that every other Nara without a Hay is going, by definition, going to be Ketana. Okay, this is a perfect place to stop. Let's recap our daf today. First part of today's daf is exploring Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says is that a woman who goes through Erusin and Nisuin, and Ksuva was written up at Erusin, and then another document was drafted up at Nisuin, the father is going to be receiving the Ksuva of that first marriage. Why? First, we attempted to say that maybe because it was written up, maybe the obligation begins at Erusin. The Gemara says, no, it's because there was a document drafted during Erusin. That document drafted at Erusin, so that speaks to now that amount is going to be indebted to the father. And that's why the father can collect from that first marriage. Good, and then that led us to an entire discussion which really captured most of our daf today, and that is what happens when I have multiple drafted documents. We discussed it in the case of Ksuva, and we discussed it in the case of sales. So first in the case of Ksuva, so we said that if I have a Ksuva followed then by a Ksuva, the woman's coming to court after a divorce, after death, and she has two Ksuvas in her hand, so how do we respond to the two Ksuvas? So if the second Ksuva is coming to be additional to the first Ksuva, perfect. So that means to say now that basically what the husband did is he wrote a second Ksuva, and again, what did he do? Gave her a choice. Either the first ksuva, which is a lower face value, but predates, so they on one hand, less money, on the other hand, more reach in terms of the ability to collect from lien properties. On the other hand, the second document is there with a greater face value, but less reach in terms of a lien. Good. And then what we did is that side by side, we spoke about multiple documents that were drafted for a sale. If the second document adds any dimension to the first document, so we have not negated the first document. On the other hand, if the second document is a simple repeat of the first document, so that's it, it negates the first document. This is the halacha of Rav Nachman. And then, how to understand Rav Nachman? The Gemara gave us two ways to understand Rav Nachman, why the second document negates the first document, either because it speaks poorly on the first document, alternatively, a mechila on the first document. Lamai nafkamina, the Gemara gave three nafkaminas in terms of the difference between the two. Are we ever going to be separating the base amount of the ksufa from the tosefis, machlokis? And the Gemara's conclusion is we're not going to separate the two. Meaning that in the event that the base amount of the ksufa was drafted up earlier, and then a tosefis was added at the point of nisuin, it's all going to be bundled together, and it's all going to be effective from the time of nisuin. That was the Gemara's conclusion. And then finally, the last thing that we covered today is the Parsha Motzi Shemra. In the parts of Motzi Shemra, so again, the Torah describes where a man suspects, accuses, and brings in witnesses that his wife committed adultery during Erusin and while she was a Nara. So now, under those circumstances, so now the stakes are ramped up. If he's right, meaning the Edom proved to be good Edom, so not only is she going to get the death penalty for adultery, but not chenek, but rather skila, and pesach beis avia. If he maligned her, the eidim proved to be no good. So now skila, he's going to get skila. He's going to have to pay mea kesef, and then he can't divorce her. Lo yuchal shachal kol yamav. On those halachas, so the details that we then covered were she has to be bisrael, she has to be Jewish. We gave the parameters of what that means. The Mishnah gave the parameters of what that means. And then what if there is no father? What if there is no father's house? Do we lose the entire halacha? No. In this particular case, we don't lose the entire halacha. We just lose that particular detail. Okay. On the Amud Beis of today's daf, Memdal Amud Beis. First, we cited sourcing for the halachas of the Mishnah, Menahan Nimili. And then a discussion, a debate amongst the Amoraim. What if a man married an orphan? She didn't have a father, and he maligned her. Is he going to be subject to all the penalties? Machlokas Amoraim. And finally, the last halacha is by Motzi Shemra, it specifically has to be when she was a Nara, not a Katana. How do we know that? Because of the hay. The Gemara says, we knew that even without the hay. Ah, but what it tells us then is that when you see Nara with a hay, it's Nara. When you see Nara without a hay, it could be Nara, it could be Katana. Adkan.